Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, we'll hear from Brian Hyland, known for Gypsy Woman, Sealed with a Kiss, and more. He first hit the charts with Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny, Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. Hyland will be in the area soon with Legends of the 60s Volume 3. It's an incredible lineup, and we'll have more on that later in the program. First, though, the MC of the event, Wink Martindale. We spoke quite recently, and of course we did talk about TV game shows, and we'll hear about that on a future program. Tonight, though, an incredible story that I never would have expected on KVC Arts from Wink Martindale's early days in radio.
It was a hot July night in 1954. I was morning man at WHBQ Radio in the Chisco Hotel in downtown Memphis, and I happened to be at the radio station this particular night, although I had to get up early and open up the radio station. We went on the air at 5 o'clock. This was before the days of 24-hour radio.
Sure, sign on and sign off.
But some of my high school football buddies from Jackson, Tennessee, had come over, and they wanted to see the studios at WHBQ. So I was showing them around, and in the middle of my little tour, I heard this commotion coming out of a studio that Dewey Phillips occupied, doing a show every night called Red Hot and Blue. Dewey was a crazy DJ. There's only been one. There'll never be another like Dewey. Just a wild DJ. Said anything, did anything, played anything, broke more records on turntables than anybody I'd ever seen just because he threw them on the turntable so hard.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right.
But he was playing this record, and I heard this commotion, and I excused myself from my group, and I went in, and it turned out that Sam Phillips, founder of Sun Records, had walked in with this acetate. Wasn't even a record yet. 3 hours earlier in the afternoon, he had recorded this truck-driving singer for Crown Electric named Elvis Presley on a song called That's All Right, Mama, an old Arthur Crudup rhythm and blues song that Elvis liked a lot. And Sam knew that if Dewey played it, he would know immediately whether or not he had a hit, because Dewey had 65% of the audience at nighttime from 9 to midnight, and if he played a record and it took off, it could be a regional hit in the Memphis area the very next day. So he played it, switchboard lit up, played it again, played seven times in a row.
Oh.
And it was just amazing. It was just this semi-country pop record called That's All Right, Mama by Elvis Presley. And I happened to be the one designated by Sam, who had the telephone number of his parents. I was designated to call him. So I called, and Mrs. Presley, Gladys, answered the phone. Of course, they were listening because they were excited, too, that the record was getting such positive response. And I said, Mrs. Presley, where's Elvis? Dewey would like for him to come down to the station to do an interview with him. And she said, well, he was so nervous about his record being played, he went to see a double feature Western at the Sousor's Theater. So they got in their truck, and they went over and walked up and down the aisle, found him sitting there by himself watching this Western, whispered to him about the excitement. He was thrilled. Brought him down to the radio station. Dewey put him on the air for his very first interview. And I met him that night, and he was my friend until the day he died. In fact, I am the only living person of six who were there that night. There was Gladys, Vernon, Sam, Elvis, Dewey, and me. And everybody's gone except me. But it was quite an evening, David, because we knew something amazing was happening, but we had no idea that music was being changed that night, and it would never, ever, ever be quite the same as it was before that hot July evening in 1954.
My gosh. Wow.
I say blue moon of Kentucky, keep on shining. Shine on the ball that's gonna let me blue.
This could be a fact or fiction. I'd love to get it straightened out from you. I understand that you have reported that Elvis admitted much later on this interview with Elvis was without him knowing that he was on the air.
That's right. He came into the studio and he sat down, and there happened to be a microphone sitting there. Dewey Phillips started asking him questions, and with every question, of course, Elvis would answer it. And after about 10 minutes of Q&A, Elvis said to Dewey, Mr. Phillips, I thought you were going to interview me. And Dewey looked at him and he said, "Son, I just did." He had no idea, Elvis didn't, that the microphone was on in front of him. In fact, he didn't even notice it. It was the first Q&A that he ever did on the air after that record came out.
Oh, my gosh.
And in fact, Sam didn't even have a B-side yet.
Oh.
It wasn't until the following Thursday he went and recorded the old Bill Monroe bluegrass song called Blue Moon of Kentucky. And they put that out on the flip side on Sun. And, of course, as they say, the rest is history.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. You went from radio to WHBQ-TV in Memphis then as the host of Mars Patrol. This was your move into TV?
That's correct. I did that for 2 complete years. And when it sort of played its way out, they came to me with another idea at the height of American Bandstand out of Philadelphia, WFIL, Dick Clark. They wanted to do a Saturday afternoon hour and a half, 90-minute show, and call it Top 10 Dance Party, where artists come on and lip-sync their records, just like American Bandstand. And so I moved from Wink Martindale of the Mars Patrol to this teenage show called Dance Party, and I had a co-hostess named Susie Bancroft, and it became an overnight hit. It was just a huge hit, sponsored for 90 minutes every Saturday afternoon, 5 to 6:30, by Coca-Cola. So I did that until I actually asked to be transferred by RKO from Memphis to Los Angeles in 1959.
Okay.
So that was my television career, the way it got started in Memphis. First Mars Patrol and then Dance Party. And then when I came out here, I was transferred by RKO and to KHJ-TV on Vine Street and did a show just like that starting in the summer of 1959. Almost 10 years I spent in Memphis were the best of my life. I thought the music of the 50s was terrific. I loved the songs. I just loved everything about that decade. In fact, I look back on my career and I think the decade of the 50s was my all-time favorite.
Nice, nice. While you were doing the Teenage Dance Party, Elvis, he made an appearance on the show. Were you able to bring him in through your friendship, or was this by this point? I mean, maybe only a couple of years later, but by this point, did you have to go through management of management and such a huge thing by then, Elvis, that is?
I had met Elvis that night in 1954, and like I said earlier, he became my friend till the day he died. And so, thanks to that friendship, he had just come to Memphis from Hollywood after doing his first picture, Love Me Tender.
Right.
And he was doing a charitable concert there at Russwood Park in Memphis, and he wanted to promote that. And, of course, dying to get him on my Dance Party show, because he was already the biggest thing since baked bread. So he came on my show. It was the first filmed interview that he had ever done. It was 1956, 2 years after I'd met him. And the security around the TV station that Saturday afternoon was unbelievable. Even the sales staff at the station, everybody came back to the station, although it was a day off for most of the working class people, but they all wanted to see Elvis Presley in person. So the station was just packed, and we had a little studio. We didn't have a lot of different high schools represented by the kids from different high schools would be the dancers. And we had a high school named Bartlett High School on that day. They were the lucky ones. And I had anticipated this interview for so long, it ended up lasting about 25 minutes. And I remember that there were so many questions that I wanted to ask Elvis, and I decided to put them on cue cards. And I slapped these questions on cue cards and put these cue cards. I had them all over the walls. I remember asking him one question during the interview. We did it in front of a jukebox where I did all my interviews. And I said, "Elvis, when you got out of Humes High School, did you have any idea that any of this would be happening to you?" He said, "Wink, I didn't expect to get out of Humes High School." And I asked him another question, and he looked at the cue card that I was reading. He said, "Well, that's what it says right there." Somebody said, we didn't have videotape at that time, 1956. Videotape machines had just come out, but the station WHBQ-TV hadn't yet purchased any. Mm-hmm. Or if they had, they hadn't arrived yet. And so somebody suggested to me, he said, "You know, you should record this interview with Elvis. It could be valuable later, because he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger." And of course, like I said, he had just done his first movie.
Yeah.
And Heartbreak Hotel had come out, his first million-selling record. And so I got Bob Zimmerman, a friend of mine, to come in and set up a 16-millimeter camera in front of the jukebox. And thank God I did, because I still have that interview. It was, about, like I said, about 25 minutes long. And I loaned it out to a couple of people, the master, over the years. And so I only have about 2 or 3 minutes remaining of the actual interview. Obviously, I have the whole thing on audio, which anybody can listen to by going to their computer. But it was quite a day and quite a memory in my career. In fact, it stands out like that night in 1954 when his first record was played by Dewey Phillips on WHBQ. Like that night, this day at Channel 13 turns out to be one of the fondest memories in my career.
Oh, just huge. I had it in my mind to ask you about some other standout moments from Teenage Dance Party, but I don't think we can, you know, we just heard about Elvis. We can't really go bigger than
that. Can't top that.
No. Before we move on from there, just one more thing about Teenage Dance Party. Any cases of some of the producers back then, say, wanting to cut someone, and then they turn out to be huge, something like that?
I was lucky, and I was truly blessed, when I look back on my career, to have been in Memphis in the 1950s, because in 54, 55, 56, that was when Sun Records was turning out hit artists like no other record label in the country, be it Decca, RCA, Columbia. This little started by Sam Phillips called Sun Records there on Union Avenue in Memphis. They were recording and making stars of people like Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins from my hometown of Jackson. You name it, there were just so many. Roy Orbison was one of those artists. My producer heard sing Ooby Dooby, his first record on Sun, and I wanted him on the show, and my producer-director said, come on, you know, let's wait till he has a hit. Well, it turned out that Ooby Dooby was a hit for Roy Orbison, and I did have him on the show. I won out over the producer, and he did come on and lip-sync Ooby Dooby, but in answer to your original question, he was one artist who almost got turned down from being on Dance Party.
Nice. That was Wink Martindale, serving as MC for Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Coming up November 16th, it's Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. The concert will be emceed by Wink Martindale, and the lineup includes Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, Jimmy Clanton, The Modern Gentleman, and our next guest, Brian Hyland. He was only 16 when he hit the top of the charts with Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. Now, we think of him as a singer and guitarist, but he actually started on clarinet.
The clarinet was just a whim kind of thing. At first, the guitar and stringed instruments, I learned how to play the banjo a little bit. But then, well, of course, when Elvis and the Everly Brothers became big stars, the guitar was the only thing.
Right, yeah, at that point. You wouldn't really want the clarinet if you could be compared to Elvis. No way. Yeah.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah. Well, you were still pretty much a kid when you co-founded the Delphi's, and I understand that you recorded a demo. There was no recording contract that came from that, but I'm curious, how or where was this recorded? Was it one of those do-it-yourself, kind of go-into-the-studio kind of things?
It was. The group was about five of us, I think, so we pooled our money together. It wasn't really that expensive. And there was a studio in Manhattan, so we went over there. It was called NOLA, N-O-L-A, Studios. And it was a pretty decent studio, I think. Ahmad Jamal, I saw his, I remember seeing his picture on the wall there when we went into the studio. But they had a deal where you could go in and cut a demo, you know, in an hour or something in that range. You know, and then they'd make copies for you right then, too.
And then you would just farm those out to whatever radio station you could walk to?
We didn't actually do that. What we did was, it was just a demo of a song that we had worked up. Two songs, actually. We did the demo, and then we got copies of the acetates. They sold us acetates, five or six acetates. Then one of the guys in the group, Lorenzo, and myself, we would cut classes, and we'd get the phone book and look at all the record companies, and we just kind of went in and busted in on him and said, would you like to hear a demo? Eventually, we met somebody in an elevator, and they said, go over to Sammy Kaye's office. They're looking for new artists over there. We went over, and there was a ranger there named Bugs Bauer, and there were different songwriters that would be coming in and out of there. They had a publishing company. And one songwriter named Kay Toomey, she was a pretty famous songwriter, they liked the way that I sang. They said, we don't need a group, but we like the way you sing, so we can work with you. So I told the guys, and they said, go for it, do it. So at that point, I became a solo artist. For about maybe 6 months or so, I was going over there. Then I actually became the office boy there at the Sammy Hayes office.
Oh.
I would deliver parcels to other music companies and publishers. And eventually, I cut a demo of a song for them called Rosemary. And that demo got sent around to the West Coast to all the people in New York who they would send it to. And when they brought it up to Cap Records, just trying to sell the song to the A&R department, and they said, who's this guy on the demo? And we like his voice. So he said, well, that's Brian Hyland. He's our office boy. So they said, he said, all right, we'd like to do it, a master recording of the song with him. You know, and that was Rick.
You had to have still only been 15, maybe 16 by this point?
Yeah, I was just going on 16.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
You're right.
After Rosemary, I read that the label employed the duo of Pockris and Vance that you just mentioned, and they were brill-building songwriters. And I wonder if at your age you could really even comprehend or appreciate someone coming from the Brill Building, because this was such a building of legend for the later years.
Sammy Kaye's office was in the Brill Building, and so I was familiar with that whole kind of scene there. You know, when you're young like that, you kind of pick up on things, on what's going on. And so I realized that, you know, there's a lot of good songwriters there. One of the first persons I ran into there who was a songwriter who was younger than most of the other ones was Fred Neil. He wrote a lot of good songs. He wrote Everybody's Talking.
Oh, wow.
He wrote the song Candyman with another writer there named Beverly Ross. Anyways, he was one of the first people that became a friend of mine, kind of casual way. So with Vance and Pockris, after that song Rosemary came out, it came out the same week as two other versions of it, one by Barry Dvorjan and one by Larry Hall. And my record came out the same week. And I got a Billboard Pick of the Week, I think I did, on my first record there. So that was pretty good. But having three different records with the same song just killed it totally. You all the time. They gave me another chance. They said, you know, let's go in and do another one. So I guess about maybe 2 months after that, and this was like in March when Rosemary came out, but then I got a phone call and said, hey, Brian, we got this song. Come over and listen to it, and we want to do a recording on this song. And the song was Itsy Bitsy Genie Weenie Yellow Polka Dot Bikini.
1, 2, 3, 4, tell the people what she wore. It was an itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini that she wore for the first time today. An itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini, so in the locker she wanted to stay.
So I took the subway and went over there to Manhattan. They played the song for me, and the demo they had of that song was three girls singing it. So it wasn't very clear to me how I was going to fit into that picture. But, you know, they explained it to me. And so anyway, we went in, I guess, about a week later and recorded it at a session with two other songs at Region Sound Studios. And it was one of those things in those days. They had two-track and three-track came in about a year later, I guess. But they recorded everything in one room, and everybody was there at the same time. So when you finished it, it was done. They mixed it and, you know, while you're getting your coat. It was a very quick process. It came out and just took off.
It sure did. And again, you were 16 when this came out, and so did you even have much choice in the early days as far as which songs you'd sing, or was it pretty much, well, one, they were assigned, and two, you were loving getting gigs, so it was as simple as that. They could throw much of anything at you, and it'd be exciting to do.
You're saying exactly what it was. I had no say in what the songs were. I liked some of the songs better than other ones, but for the most part, on the first album I did there for Cap Records,
mm-hmm.
was mostly standards from the 40s and, you know, Paper Doll and A Year Adorable, songs like that. And they tried to update the arrangements, but the thing was that I don't know where their heads were at to do that kind of thing, but it was a quick process anyway, and they got the album out. And there was a couple of tracks on the album that actually sold really good in the Far East, Japan and Southeast Asia. And when we go over there, I do those songs. In fact, I'm going over to Bangkok to play a gig over there in December with Peggy March. Both of us are going to go over there. There are a couple of the songs, for instance, the song Babyface. They did a version of Babyface, and they just kind of used the same riff from Polka Dot Bikini, only did it kind of inside out. And they used that as the little riff leading into the song. That sold really good over there in Japan and other places over there. Anyway, that was my first thing, but I didn't really have much to say about this song. I take that back in a sense, because it was one song that I did called I Gotta Go, which was written by John D. Loudermilk. And they played that for me, and they were kind of unsure about that. But I said, I really like this song. It's a cool song. And that was the exception, I guess.
Nice. Okay. Well, that's really cool that you were able to, I guess, ask for some things at some point. And again, at the age of 16, I'm speaking with more and more folks like Lala Brooks, for example, maybe 13 or 14 when her hits were coming out there. And I wonder about the tours and if you had to have chaperones, but we'll get to the tours. But with Itsy Bitsy, for example, catchy, fun tune. Okay. And you sang it. It was fun. You had the girls in the background, and you came through. But could you even imagine it? It would have the success that it did. It sold, I read this, over 2 million copies in total, and it sold almost a million of those 2 million in the first 2 months of its release. How is it that you were hearing, would you get a call from your manager every so often? Were you listening to the radio and saying, oh my God, here I am again?
That's a good point. When the record came out, all my brothers, I had six brothers and one sister, and we lived in Woodhaven in Queens in New York City. So after about a week or so, all my brothers said they had heard it on the radio. But for some reason, I was going back and forth to New York and doing all kinds of weird stuff. Anyway, so this one night, my brother Ken, who was probably about 6 or 7 years older than me, he had a car. So we went out to this hamburger place down by Kennedy Airport, in that general area by Howard Beach. It was in the evening, and we pull up to a stoplight. Another car pulled up at the stoplight, and there all these teenagers were in the car, and they had the radio blasting, and my song came on as we're at the stoplight. And the weird thing was, they were all singing it. It really blew me away. We got that station on the radio, and that was the first time that I heard it on the radio from somebody else's car. It was a great experience. You always remember, I guess, in movies and things like that, the first time that somebody hears their song on the radio, but it is actually a real thrill.
That was a real American Graffiti kind of moment right there. Could you or your brother resist saying, hey, that's me, or hey, yo, that's my brother. He's sitting right here. Did you call attention to that other car?
No, we didn't do anything like that.
Oh,
no,
gosh.
We just listened to it, and we were just, like, excited, I guess.
All right. Okay. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Brian Hyland, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s Volume 3, along with Jimmy Clanton, The Modern Gentleman, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, and emceed by Wink Martindale. That's in Ontario, November 16th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org.
Make me your slave. Tie me down, make me behave, let me belong to you.
You moved on to ABC Paramount, and so I'm curious, with such huge success with Itsy Bitsy, Teeny, etc., why did you switch labels? You did end up with further hits from Gary Geld and Peter Adele. Let Me Belong to You and I'll Never Stop Wanting You, for example. But why did you switch labels with such wonderful success?
Cap Records, after Polka Dot Bikini, they, like everybody that ever wrote a novelty song, brought them up there. And they were just inundated with novelty songs. And they were like just pegging me with that kind of thing, with novelty songs. And I didn't think that was what I wanted to do, because the people that I was listening to before that and all was Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly, Jackie Wilson, Frankie Lyman, you know, all the things that were really rock and roll stuff. So I met two songwriters in that period of time, Gary Gill and Peter Udell, and we recorded a test thing or a demo, whatever you want to call it, of Let Me Belong to You. Then we went in and recorded a master session with that song, and that was brought up to ABC Paramount, and they liked it. And the, one of the things that I was lucky at that very point was that Paul Anka had just left ABC Paramount and went to RCA. So it was, you know, a good opportunity. They were looking for somebody in that, you know, a teenage artist, I guess.
Yeah.
So I filled the bill. Anyway, so we released that. Let Me Belong to You went up to number 20 on the charts.
Yeah.
The luckiest thing that ever happened to me was that Dick Clark really liked that song and that particular record and started playing it on American Bandstand.
Mm.
That helped me immensely getting another chance, at getting another shot.
Yes, indeed.
But toss to and fro make me your own. Never, never leave me alone. Make all my dreams come true. Let me belong to you.
I want to go back to Dick Clark's Caravan in just a moment, really, but in 1961, I believe, you appeared as yourself on To Tell the Truth, a game show that we had at one point, a really cool, fun game show. I really enjoyed this in reruns. This was the one where there's three folks up there. One person has to tell the truth. The other two guys, they can bluff their way through, and then the panel has to decide which one of you is telling the truth. So, one, I guess, were they trying to figure out which one of you was Brian Hyland, or were you one of the couple of folks bluffing your way through? And also, how did this even come to be? How did you end up on TV? Is this your manager saying, hey, we got this kid, he's a triple threat, let's do it?
Yeah, it was set up, I guess, a week or so before, and it was all done really quick. It was three people, and we stood at the top of this little set, and I said, my name is Brian Hyland, and the other guy said, and they were playing my record. And then they went on and said, you know, I was going to high school in Brooklyn and just put out this record, and it was a big hit. They asked us all questions. And actually, I'll tell you, that clip is on YouTube right now. You can watch it.
Though we gotta say goodbye for the summer, darling, I promise you this, I'll send you all my love every day in a letter sealed with a kiss.
One of the biggest songs for you next to Itsy Bitsy, of course, would be Sealed with a Kiss, and this was just a couple of years later. So again, you were not even 20. And this one hit at least number three or so. It stayed up there for quite some time. Such a different feel for you, though, as far as what the public might have been looking for. You already made it clear that you weren't interested in the Lieber and Stoller type of coasters, the novelty type songs. And so this, though, Sealed with a Kiss, a beautiful harmony-ridden song, which got a resurgence maybe 30 years later. We'll address that one also. Did you wonder about this at all, as far as approaching the public with a different sound than one might expect from Brian Hyland?
Well, at that point, I had been working with Gelden Udell for a year. And so right before Sealed with a Kiss, we did a song called Ginny Come Lately.
Yeah.
It went to number 20 in Europe, in England, and different countries like in Northern Europe, in Holland, in Sweden, and Germany. It was a huge hit, Ginny Come Lately was. And that was the first one I did, I sang harmony on. They wanted a specific harmony line, and, you know, I learned that. Then, actually, with Sealed with a Kiss, Gary Geld, they had released that song, I don't know exactly, I think probably about a year before, by a group called the Four Voices. And the Four Voices were in the kind of mold of the Brothers Four. So they did it in a real kind of somber kind of way. And it was a nice record, but they updated it using electric guitars, drums, and bongos, and a lot of stuff on there. It was good. Plus, they had a really good chorus. Stan Applebaum, who was a really good arranger, who did a lot of the arrangements, actually, for the Drifters and Benny King, he did really cool stuff. Tickle the Kiss, a lot of people think there's strings on it, but it's not. The only thing in the background is a harmonica part, which is really nice, and three or four girl singers. They did a really nice arrangement for the vocal. Anyway, so that was the second one I did where I did a harmony to it, and Gary Gill wanted a specific harmony on that song, which he had worked out, I guess, on the piano. So I learned two songs, really. I learned the song, the melody, the regular, and then I learned the song as the harmony part, and that worked out pretty good.
Was that with a live overdub then, with you coming in with the harmony?
Well, in those days, you know, it was kind of a situation where you had to really be sneaky, because the union in New York, they don't do that anymore, but in those days, if you were going to overdub your vocal, they wanted you to do that on the session while all the musicians sat there. And the thing was that the musicians never made any mistake, hardly, and the person that would be making mistakes would be the vocalist. You know, we were there on the floor. They had a vocal booth, of course, but anyway, so we did the basic tracks, we cut them, and I did a vocal, just the melody. Then we went to another studio with that and like the harmony part on. And they had to, like, watch for the union to show up, and it was kind of was just a funny situation. But anyway, that worked out really good, and learning it that way as a separate song.
Nice. Well, I guess by the time you were 20, you were on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars in 1963 in Dallas on the day of the assassination of President Kennedy. You wrote a song about this mail order gun, and this was eventually released 7 years later or so.
The song was just the title. I kept seeing that in the newspapers. That's how he got the gun, Oswald. But the song that I wrote with that, I thought that was kind of a dramatic title, and I used that title from those newspapers. The song that I wrote was nothing Kennedy or anything like that.
Okay.
In fact, for a long time, I didn't even talk about that day in my life. It was so negative, and I saw him go by, and Myron Lee, who was the guy that was the band leader, we walked up there and we waited, and then we heard the motorcade coming. It went by, and I could see Jackie Kennedy real good. I was on that side of the street, and then I could see President Kennedy's hair just a little bit, and they went by pretty quick. And, you know, within probably 10 minutes or less than that, it was on the radio that he'd been shot, and it was maybe about 6 blocks or 7 blocks from where I was, maybe less than that. That was just probably the worst day of my life, you know, just after. I never saw any political figure before at that point. I'd never been in any proximity where anybody like that was. And President Kennedy was, you know, the first one, and bam, he got it.
Wow.
It was terrible.
You were fortunate, and maybe the best day of your life, having gotten to be able to see him and Jackie, and then going quickly to the worst day. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Coming up November 16th at Gardner Spring Auditorium in Ontario, it's Legends of the 60s Volume 3. More at affordablemusicproductions.com, though the lineup includes Jimmy Clanton, Paul and Paula, Bobby Rydell, Dodie Stevens, The Modern Gentleman, and tonight's guest, Brian Hyland. He has new material out, and we'll hear about it a bit later in the program. Also just ahead, some of his music, which he felt had been overshadowed by the incredible success of Itsy Bitsy, Sealed with a Kiss, and others. Also on another Dick Clark Caravan, this in 1965, one of the groups that was also on the bill, along with you, was Jimmy Ford's Executives. Okay, and the significance of this is that the bass player was Terry Kath, who would end up being the monster guitarist with Chicago. Now, as a bass player, or maybe you even didn't have much interaction with these folks, but I have to know if there was any indication back then as a bass player that he would become who he ended up becoming.
Well, they were really friendly guys, the group Jimmy Ford's Band, and they had different incarnations of that group. You know, they were called the Mob at a certain point. And there was a pool of musicians in Chicago, of horn players, guitar players, bass players. And so Jimmy Ford was, in a way, like a contractor. And he would, you know, put different bands together for Dick Clark. And one of the bands, actually, there was a guitar player on it. This is later on, a guy named Jimmy Holvey. I shouldn't say a guy. He was a really great songwriter, and he wrote the song Kind of a Drag.
Uh-huh.
And he was a guitar player on the tour. And on that same tour was James Gersio. He was on the bass, and he became the producer for Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and later had his own studio out in Colorado somewhere. There was a lot of good musicians from Chicago, from that pool of musicians that we worked with, and Terry Kath was one of those musicians. And on the tour that I did with Terry, you know, he, like you said, he was playing bass. I just remember him as being a fun guy, and he played bass great. He was a great bass player.
Okay.
I'm afraid to go home. I'm afraid to go home. Worries on my mind. Afraid of what I'll find. Will my family be gone? I'm afraid to go on. Back to Tennessee. Afraid of what I'll say.
There were some songs that came out a little bit later. Oh, gosh, I read this phrase. It surely wasn't on your website, that is, which is just simply brianhyland.com. But I read elsewhere, I think, it says, well, the teen idol thing faded, and so he went in different direction. And, you know, I hate those kinds of quotes. It's like, you know, wow, this went away. But, but you know, I mean, you weren't a 16-year-old anymore. So you then started doing things like I'm Afraid to Go Home. And this one, after Bodie pointed it out to me, I was in a bit of conversation with him about some tunes that you feel may have gotten overlooked. When I listen to I'm Afraid to Go Home, it really feels like it's a pleasant song, and I listened to it probably a dozen times before actually going into the words. And I would almost swear that you are not from New York, but rather from Tennessee, and you're bemoaning the changes that you might encounter when you go home. I'd like to hear about this song in your eyes. This was one penned by other folks, but covered nicely
by Gary Geld and Peter Udell. Also,
yes.
They wrote that, the ones that wrote Fuel the Kiss and Ginny Come Lately. They were my producers, and they were the primary songwriters also at that time for most of the songs that we released as singles. But anyway, on that song, I came back in from doing some shows, and they said, Brian, we have this song we just wrote. It's about the Civil War. Are you going to like it? He played it on the piano, and he played that riff that's on the record on the piano. I said, oh, yeah, this is a different kind of a song. And I wanted to have some different kind of a sound, and that fit the bill. It has the line in the end, Sherman's been in my town.
Yes.
Burned it all to the ground. Now there's not a tree between Memphis and the sea. You know, interesting thing, I was on a tour in England. Every night on the bus, I had this book called Cold Mountain, which was made into a movie. And the book Cold Mountain, in a lot of ways, is about a guy trying to get home back to his girl. It was just kind of a similar story. Mm-hmm. And I would be singing that every night on stage, so we worked a nice arrangement of that so we could do it on that tour. It was a cool song. And in fact, this is an interesting thing. When it first came out, I flew out of New York to do a show with Lou Christie. I got there to the hotel, and Lou says, hey, this song is going to be a smash. So he called up Diana Ross. And he said, did you hear this song by Brian? And she said, yeah, it's great. I want to record it with the Supremes. I didn't think that was going to happen. But Lou and Diana Ross, they liked that record. And, of course, you know, it didn't really become a big hit. But in the places where it got good airplay, it became kind of a sleeper hit.
I'm afraid to go home. I'm afraid to go home. Sherman's been in my town. Burned it all to the ground. Now there's not a tree between Memphis and the sea. Now there's not a tree between Memphis and the sea.
Could you dig it, baby?
did you also play harmonica on some of these tunes or around the same period?
No, they had this harmonica player who was really good named Blackie Schachter. He had a chromatic harmonica. They'd give him the music sheet, and he could just read it, play it the first time through. You know, and he would, you know, make a little adjustments, you know, if they wanted slurs or different things like that with their harmonica. But I learned how to play the harmonica kind of later on stage. A couple of tunes that I do, the harp solo on Seal with a Kiss.
Oh, nice.
And I also have a version that we do of Whiter Shade of Pale, and I played the solo on the harmonica on that song.
Oh, beautiful. Wow. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Brian Hyland, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s Volume 3, along with Jimmy Clanton, The Modern Gentleman, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, and emceed by Wink Martindale. That's in Ontario, November 16th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I want to cover some pieces a little bit later. Oh, I don't know, if we're looking at chronologically, we're hovering around 1970 or so now. These would be the pieces involving Del Shannon, which...
Yeah.
Leads me to, I really want to say these should have been a runaway hit. You knew Del Shannon and worked with him and or alongside him in the past, I guess going back easily close to another 10 years prior. But how did you end up working with him in the studio with him serving as producer?
I had moved out to California then. This is in the late 60s. So for a while, Del said, come on, you can stay at my house. So I said, oh, great. So we were writing a lot of songs at that time. We wrote a lot of country songs, and besides that, we had, pop songs we were writing. Well, we're going to do a session with some of these songs. And so the first session we did, we had a song which is on my album called Could You Dig It?
Yes.
And we recorded that as an independent production, brought it up to MCA Records, which was Uni Records at the time. They had an office on Sunset Boulevard, and Russ Reagan was the head honcho there. So we played it for him, and he liked it, and so they signed me up to Uni Records, MCA. So that came out, and I think that's one of those that should have been a hit, because we put a lot of thought into it and everything, and nice harmony parts on it, too. Then we went back in and recorded some more stuff that we had written, and we thought, well, if these don't come out too good, we got to have an ace in the hole. So then we were like, brainstorming, trying to come up with, what song should we do? And then Gypsy Woman just kind of came out of nowhere, and we said, yeah, we're going to record Gypsy Woman. That's going to be the song. It came out great. It just blew the other songs away that we had written and the other songs on the session. It's such a great song, really.
And it has the Curtis Mayfield name behind it as well,
right.
Or if people even associated that, or if they were just thinking of The Impressions or whatever at that point. But yeah, that was a huge, huge one for you. With Could You Dig It? I don't know if I read this. Did you and Del Shannon write that one literally passing the guitar back and forth, trading verses? Talk to me a little bit more about Could You Dig It, this one coming together. I almost feel like it was around, as in you writing a verse, handing it off to him. He would write a verse. Was it truly that kind of a thing?
Yeah, we wrote it really fast, maybe in 2 days. And that's how we would write. But only we didn't have to pass it. We both had guitars.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
We didn't have to do that. But with that song, it started out. I had this Bobby Goldsboro show me this weird chord. So I showed that to Del, and he says, oh, that's a great chord. So Del was always looking for new chords and things like that. Was one of his things that he liked. And so I played that for him, and he said, yeah, let's use that as the first chord on the song. So then that kind of led us into the song, and it was just a real quick process.
I want to get to I Want It All, but a couple of things before that, because you had a couple of tunes. Beyond the tunes that we just mentioned, you also did another cover, Lonely Teardrops, the Jackie Wilson tune, and this was again another Del Shannon produced. So you had a couple of tunes getting a resurgence, even a couple of times. Sealed with a Kiss came back out in 1975, and then later on there was a Dutch singer, Albert West. Tell me about this guy. You get a call from this singer, Albert West. Did you already know him, or was this kind of out of the blue? You wanted to record...
It was out of the blue, yeah. I think that whole thing with Albert West, the way that started was, Albert West, actually, he has passed away. He was a really nice person. And his management and the people that he worked with over in Holland, I think they saw me on that Rock and Roll Palace with Wolfman Jack. It was on TV. And so they said, oh, Brian's, he still can sing. And and he actually had recorded a version of Jeannie Come Lately, which was a big hit for him in Northern Europe, in Germany and Holland, Belgium. So they contacted the agency I was working with, and they said, would you be interested in going over and re-recording Seal of the Kiss and Yellow Polka Dot Bikini with Albert West? And they had a studio in Roosmalen, Holland, which is in the southern part of Holland. Yeah, we said, yeah, that'll be great. So we went over there and did that recording. It was on an album with a bunch of other songs that he did, some with Albert Hammond Jr. He did some stuff with Hal Shapiro, some Neil Sedaka songs, Right Next Door to an Angel, I think is one he did. He was an innovative kind of singer, and he had a really good following up there also. So we did a couple of television shows, and they released Polka Dot Bikini as a single off the album. So that was kind of where that stood.
With you on TV in Germany and Belgium and all that, do you speak any German at all?
Actually, no. I mean, I recorded some things in German. Seal of the Kiss, we did a German version. It was called Schön war die Zeit. And Jeannie Come Lately was called Ginny O Ginny. We did that one in German also. But I was told by some of the German artists, they said they liked my English version much better.
Oh, that's going to be my next search. As soon as we hang up, I'll be looking for the German version, Sealed with a Kiss in Deutsche. Wow.
In den Bäumen singt der Wind, so wie damals, von Liebe und Liebesleid, und ich bin so allein, und denk immer das eine, schön war die Zeit, schön war die Zeit, schön war die I never wanted anything until I looked into your eyes. Perfect love, so hard to find. Found each other just in time. Made it through tears and pain. We could even stand a rain.
Well, now, jumping up, I guess, 30 years later, I Want It All. This is a new single. You've written with so many songwriters in the past, beyond Could You Dig It, that one has your name credited on it, along with Del Shannon, but I Want It All, did you write that one?
Yes, I did. Well, with the help of my son, we were driving and we were talking about something, and he said, oh, no, I Want It All. Oh, that's a great title. You know, I did the production, the whole thing myself. I produced it, I played all the instruments on it, and did mixed it and did the whole thing with the help of a Macintosh computer.
Isn't Bodie your drummer sometimes?
Yeah, all the time, yeah. He travels with me on the road, and he's also my driver now.
Well, you know, I asked this a lot, and you partially answered it in that it came about from a statement driving in the car one day, but I think this is a fair question, and that is, I Want It All. Was this, once you got beyond this great catchphrase, if you will, I Want It All, did the song end up being written for someone specific, or is it more of an overall idyllic situation, you know, spoken more in general terms?
I would say both. My wife, who passed away last December, she was on my mind. You think of that in that sense as a personal thing, but also in a general sense that with a love story, you want everything. So that was kind of personal, but in a general way, not.
That's a beautiful, beautiful tune, and I have to know if this is going to appear on an upcoming album, if you have anything in the works like that.
Well, I'm working on stuff right now. I'm working on three different songs in my studio. So, yeah, but you know, the whole thing is that nowadays, the record business that I got into in 1960 when I started it, that's gone.
But in
a certain sense, it's back, because now people, they target one song, and you can just download one song, you stream it. So I think, in a sense, people are back to just cherry-picking one song, because I think in the 80s, the record companies were putting out singles, but they had 11 B-sides.
Yeah.
That kind of died. That really hurt the record business because there was a lot of just clutter.
Yes.
That's what I could call it, you know, and it didn't really help the record business at all.
Something else that this downloadable singles really almost eliminated, and that is folks trying to put some sort of a flow to their album. Having a good linear flow, like a good story or a joke or any book, an album should have the same thing, that beginning point, that thing that makes you want to go to the next one in a crescendo and then coming off for some sort of...
You're right. That is missing, in a sense, with a lot of productions that people do nowadays. You know, with the exception of country artists like Chris Stapleton. Mm-hmm. He's great. I like Chris Stapleton. There was this one group, the Civil Wars. They were a couple of years ago, and they broke up, but they were great. I thought they were going to go on, you know, for years. And they had kind of thematic kind of things on their LPs or their CDs. So I think in the country field, that's still a thing that they do.
I hope so. I really like I Want It All. I like it as much as the tunes that I heard in the past. I think some of my favorite stuff from you hovers around 1970, which means we went from my mom's era into my era, because I was alive in 1970. I was a child, but this stuff through AM radio, like Gypsy Woman and some of these songs, continued. These songs, you spanned several generations. I suppose you are still seeing this at the concerts that you perform at. You're seeing people who saw you when you were new, and, well, they were new also, and now they're 78 and coming to your shows again and bringing their grandchildren. You're really passing on this torch.
I'm glad to do it. I'm glad to bring people along with the songs. And, you know, it seems that the songs from the 60s and from the 50s, there was so much care put into those productions, especially, you know, the singles. They would really try to make a masterpiece out of each single, like Phil Spector did that, you know, with a lot of the stuff
he did.
But even like Adele and different people, Peter and Gordon or Tom Jones, the songs that they would focus on in those sessions, they would throw everything at the kitchen sink if they had to. And so it shows, after all the years, that there was a lot of care put into all those productions. It shows.
Music from and conversation with Brian Hyland. Hyland's part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s, Volume 3, along with Jimmy Clanton, The Modern Gentleman, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, and emceed by Wink Martindale. That's in Ontario, November 16th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Brian Hyland, Wink Martindale, and Nathan Goethals of Affordable Music Productions for the contacts. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Shireen Awad, and Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year, quick and easy, at kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.